listings available at...
It's all things political on this hour of the Kathleen Dunn Show. Good afternoon, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Every Monday afternoon at this time, we review the top political news here on the Kathleen Dunn Program and get your take on those issues. My guest today, Lily Gordon, professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, always good to talk with you.
Hi, John. How are you?
How's digging up from all that snow you got down there?
A lot of snow.
You know, I'm on the other end of the state from you, and we basically got, I don't know, half an inch. It was sunny yesterday. It was a beautiful day. Anyway, we have a lot of stuff to talk to on all things political today. Before we get into the heavy drifts of presidential politics and state and federal budgets, yeah, I know that was kind of a cheap shot. I saw an interesting take on the Super Bowl while trying to avoid watching it yesterday. By the way, just for the record, I haven't watched the Super Bowl since 1977. If you're a Seattle fan, of course, the game may have left a bad taste in your mouth, but if you're a taxpayer in Glendale, Arizona, where the game was played, it might be more than just a bad taste in your mouth. Let's talk a little bit about the impact of sports stadiums on local taxpayers. A big deal out there in Glendale and actually in other venues where the Super Bowl has been held as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and you're starting to see some of the discussion here in Milwaukee, at least, not necessarily where you are, John, about, you know, another stadium for the Bucks. So this is the perennial discussion when either you're building or rebuilding a sports stadium. It also goes to some of the discussion around, you know, if you're trying to pursue your city or country is pursuing the Olympics. And the cost for that, I think we saw a lot of that last year in Brazil with regard to the World Cup and the Olympics that are coming there. It's a very expensive undertaking for any municipality or region, and you don't always see a whole lot of return on your investment.
Well, Glendale's case is maybe a little bit more involved than that. They made some pretty heavy bets as a city on professional sports. They built a new football stadium for the Arizona Cardinals, which was the site of yesterday's Super Bowl. They let's see, what else did they build? They built a hockey arena for the Phoenix Coyotes, who then went bankrupt.
Right.
They built a, let's see, what else was it they built? I think it was a baseball facility. So, I mean, they've put a lot of money into sports stadiums, and the taxpayers are on the hook for a lot of this, and it's really cost them, it's really caused them to have to scramble to pay for city services. They put a lot of money into the security for the Super Bowl, and as I understand it, they didn't get reimbursed for any of it.
Right, and the mayor couldn't go to the Super Bowl either.
Yeah, I mean, that was insult to injury. He didn't even get offered a ticket. And
yeah.
he got criticism, actually, from both the NFL and the owner of the Cardinals for being a bad sport. Okay, well, enough about the Super Bowl. let's talk about what's going on here in the Badger State, because well, a lot of times we know all things political and we have a political analyst from outside the state. We don't necessarily get to zero in on some of these state issues. Last week, Governor Scott Walker unveiled one of his budget proposals, and we'll hear about more about that tomorrow night in his budget address, that would reduce the UW system budget by $300 million over 2 years, about $150 million a year. Along with that cut, the governor is offering what he calls flexibilities, which is to say the UW would operate, as I understand it, as a public authority, with the regents calling all the shots instead of answering to the legislature, as is the case now. And it would also get rid of, and I'm going to get this wrong probably, I think it's Chapter 36 of state law, which governs the university and has a specific language in it about things like faculty governance. The budget proposal, though, also calls for a continuation of the tuition freeze through 2017. Okay, let's talk about this. Even some GOP members of the legislature are concerned about the depth of this cut, particularly as it comes on the heels of a $250 million cut in the last biennium. So your take on what the governor announced last week?
Well, I think, you know, again, the university system here is one of the prides and joys and impressive features of the state of Wisconsin. And Madison leads, certainly, and, you know, as a lot of the articles on the topic have noted, Madison leads in lots of ways among all universities in the United States with regard to patents, research that's produced, the kind of work that the faculty and students do there, and they have been sustaining, not just Madison, but the entire UW system has been sustaining a number of these cuts over the last couple of years, and then to have on top of that yet another super substantial, potentially, cut across the board. So it's not just Madison, it's UWM, it's, you know, Eau Claire, it's Parkside, it's Oshkosh, all the parts of the system. And a lot of the universities are operating in many ways pretty close to the bone in terms of what they can do.
Well, and we have a comment from Wendy on Facebook that's particularly pertinent here. Wendy writes, why are we accepting privatization of our entire commons? Our public education in Wisconsin is being starved and privatized. If you take a look at the percentage of the UW budget that actually comes from state tax dollars, I believe it's 20% or less now. And, of course, at one time it was pretty much 100%. I mean, the state, it was a land-grant institution. The state financed it. There was a great deal of value placed on the intellect and on research and investigation and finding things out and then transmitting that knowledge across the state. That's the Wisconsin idea. We're kind of seeing a reversal of that. There seems to be a real, I don't want to call it a spirit of anti-intellectualism, but there certainly seems to be some pushback against the idea of financing a university.
Yeah, and it's not also only in Wisconsin that you're seeing this, and you've seen it over the last couple of decades, that the public university systems across the country have essentially gone from, you know, close to 100% or, you know, 80% being paid for by the taxpayers of whatever state you're in, to at this point many of them being paid for less than, you know, 40 or 30% by public funds. They're massive fundraising institutions at this point, which is, again, another expense that the universities have taken on to continue to maintain excellence. But I do think that they're, you know, that there seems to be, at least in terms of what I'm reading, not a lot of discussion of the actual value of what a university brings to a state or a community, in terms of, as you noted, John, knowledge, engagement, the sort of education for citizenry, which is a lot of what's in most state university charters, that they're responsible to some degree for training citizens. So it's not just patenting, you know, stem cells. It's also about teaching people, like, here are the three branches of government, and this is how public services work, and this is how you get involved.
Well, and if it wasn't for the University of Wisconsin, the dairy industry probably wouldn't be as big a deal as it is today in the state. So, I mean, a lot of history there. One of the things that happened in connection with this, it wasn't just the announcement of the $300 million cut and the quote-unquote reforms to how the university operates. The governor went on talk radio in Milwaukee last week and made comments basically saying, you know, he doesn't think the full-time faculty at the UW work hard enough. And under his plan, the regents could force them to teach more. I saw a bunch of reactions from faculty members who identify themselves as Republican, and they had some pretty harsh words for Governor Walker. Let's talk a little bit about this issue. This almost begins to sound like dog whistle politics. He was speaking to the base who maybe don't trust intellectuals and who never think who tend not to think that teaching is a difficult profession, whatever the level, and the common belief is that college professors have a pretty cushy job. Let's talk about that stereotype, but also I want to talk about politically what the governor was doing when he made those remarks.
I don't know if it may be, in fact, some form of, as you noted, dog whistle politics. But it's also, you know, sort of, it is part of the sort of broader discussion, as you also suggested, with regard to how hard can it really be to teach? You know, how much time do you really spend doing that? And, you know, any professor who's only teaching two or three classes a semester can teach another class every semester. And the folks out at Boise State have done a small study of, you know, how much time your average professor actually spends working. And the work that professors do is not just teaching, because you're in the classroom for, you know, a couple hours a day, or, you know, I'll be in the classroom for 6 hours in the course of the day tomorrow. But there's also a lot of time obviously spent preparing for classes, and then, of course, grading students' work. But apparently we also all spend a lot of time in meetings. People are always calling us to meetings. And we also respond to a lot of email from students and other people.
And you get asked to be on radio talk shows.
We get asked to be on radio talk shows that we have to prepare to be on. And then we're also supposed to be producing, you know, original research, which may be done in the lab, or it may take time to read books or articles. And then you have to write this stuff, which also takes a little bit of time. And the average work week for your basic professor at any level, assistant, associate, full, is over, according to the folks at Boise State, is around 60 hours a week, which is 20% more than a 40-hour work week. And it also includes a lot of work on the weekends.
Well, as someone who used to teach at a university, at two different universities, I can tell you there were a lot of times when I was up until 1 or 2 in the morning during finals week, regretting the fact that I assigned that 15-page research paper
to a
class of 120 students in film genres. But most people don't think about that. Oh, you guys don't do any work. And I used to get that from friends. Boy, you have a cushy job.
Right.
And you know, for me, I enjoyed doing it. And so it was work, yes, and it was hard work, and I spent a lot of time doing it, but it wasn't like I wasn't enjoying myself, but perhaps you're not supposed to do that. So I don't know, this just seems to be, it's generated some discussion, and that may have been the governor's intent. Let's take a quick call here from Willem in Colfax, because he has something to say about this particular issue. Willem, thanks for joining us today.
Hello. And good afternoon. I think the governor, in his talk on the psych show about teachers should work harder, that's, you know, like you were saying, it's targeted toward a certain audience, people, a sort of an anti-intellectual, those teachers, they got it all easy and they make so much money, and that whole attitude. But, you know, Bill Gates called the University of Wisconsin one of the best universities in the world, and he understands that research that happens at the university and the quality of the researchers at the university has a direct effect on the economy in not only this country but in Wisconsin for sure. And all the universities, the towns that they're in, are impacted by the economic activity of the university. And I think the governor has sent a clear message to every young professor, young researcher, is we don't respect you, we don't want you, you know, we don't think that what you do is valuable. So, you know, if I was a young professor and I heard that message, I would get it loud and clear, you know, don't come to Wisconsin. And the same young people are moving from this state because of this punitive anti-education attitude, this divide-and-conquer strategy that our governor is pursuing. I think it's really had a very negative effect on our state. I've been in business for over 30 years. These past 4 years of Walker administration have been the worst years I've ever had. And partly it's because he keeps cutting these, you know, people who have decent jobs, who have money to spend in restaurants and coffee shops and all the things that drive an economy, and he doesn't seem to understand that. And, I cannot believe that this attack on the university, I mean, you know, it's unacceptable.
Willem, thanks so much for the call. Lily, I'm going to have you hold your response to what Willem had to say until after we get back from the break. This is All Things Political. Your chance to weigh in on what you thought maybe was a great political story over the last week at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, toll free. And you can also send an email, talk@WPR.org. Or join us on social media. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and on Twitter and share your thoughts, questions, comments, ideas with us that way. We have, as I expected, full phones right now. So if you get a busy signal, keep trying, or send us an email instead, or post to Facebook or Twitter, and that'd also be a good way to communicate. All right, Lily Gorin is my guest. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. It is All Things Political. I'm John Munson, in for the vacationing Kathleen Dunn, who, by the way, in case you're wondering, will be back next week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson, in for the vacationing Kathleen Dunn, who will be back next Monday. Lily Gorin is my guest. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. I think a number of people want to get in on the governor's budget address, which is upcoming, but particularly on his comments on the university. Let's take a few of those phone calls, Lily.
Okay.
Well, actually, why don't you respond to what Willem had to say, and then we've got a few more calls along the same vein. I want to take those and then talk about Governor Walker's presidential campaign.
Yeah, one of the things that Willem noted, which I had also previously mentioned, is the research aspect of someplace like Madison, which is world-renowned. I mean, University of Wisconsin-Madison is a world-renowned institution because of the research that's produced there, scientific research, historical research, all kinds of research that's done by scholars and academics there. But it's also not just Madison. When we're talking about the UW system, we're also talking about the research that's done at UWM. We're talking about the research that's done at UW Parkside, and so forth. It's that, and as well as the teaching, which is, of course, one of the goals of the land-grant colleges, was to teach the citizens of the state. And, you know, you can potentially teach more students if you have more classes that you're required to teach, but the capacity that you have then to do research or to, you know, develop new classes is severely limited because you're always teaching.
Yeah, and just the idea that there is value in intellectual inquiry is one that the university has really had a hard time selling in recent years. Let's take a call from Jane in Superior. Jane, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, hi. This is wonderful to have this opportunity to talk about this. I'm hearing the emphasis on research and teaching, and that, of course, is you know, that'll be criticized. I attended UW-Madison as an older student. I went back when I was 32. Prior to that, I had a small business up north here, and I had a history degree I hadn't finished. I worked many jobs. I went back, and I fell into, well, basically became a library and information studies person, went to the UW, got into the State Historical Society, became an archivist, and later on, when I moved somewhere with an academic who taught for 25 years, I had an incredibly well-prepared background, and I lived overseas, and my experience with the university system was miles ahead of what I experienced. It's not just about teaching or research. It's about critical, being able to think critically, and that's what's going to get you ahead in the business and all, you know, any job you're going to have. Just another thing quickly is that I know that we're forgetting how hard people worked to pull together a well-crafted UW system. This feeds into what you're saying about this is not just Madison. Also, this goes back to the 19th century, the Wisconsin idea. Land grant, this is for all of the citizens in the state of Wisconsin. We have access to all of the services there, be they libraries, courses, and many of them are very low. They're very accessible financially. One very last thing, which I just cannot get over, is that my grandpa in the 1920s attended UW-Madison Ag School. He was a butter and cheese maker for many, many years in Mason and Hayward, Wisconsin. He has been where he had been in terms of running a very successful small business had he not had access back then in the 1920s to this high quality. People from around the world would die to get here. The sociology department, the engineering department, these people come from all over the world to attend UW-Madison and also Eau Claire. There are so many here I'm forgetting. But I'll take my words off the air and just let you respond. Thank you.
Jane, thanks so much for your call. Lily?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jane is reiterating a lot of the points that we've been making, that you can't create a world-class university system overnight, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes, you know, you have to have a sort of a atmosphere that also is inclined towards developing intellectual inquiry and is wants to have people who are doing research, who are teaching, who are developing new ideas. You know, we have here down in Milwaukee at UW-Milwaukee, we have the School of Freshwater Sciences, which is the first one of its kind. And we're particularly well positioned given our proximity to Lake Michigan, among other things, for this kind of, you know, this kind of a school, this kind of work that will be done there, the kind of students who are interested in coming there. Again, it will attract people from all over the world.
And I should put in a plug for my alma mater, UW-Superior, which has the Lake Superior Research Institute.
Exactly.
I think I left out an S there. Somebody's going to call me on that. And so there's certainly a lot going on. Well, I mean, we could extol the merits of the university system all afternoon. At the end of the day, however, the state of Wisconsin has a significant budget shortfall, and you can debate about how big it is. But there's more demand than there is cash in the till, and so something's going to have to get cut. Let's move on, and again, I mean, we could do a whole hour on the university and its value to this state, and I think we've probably taken that discussion as far as we can. Governor Walker, of course, is also a presidential candidate, and he's got a TV ad out. He made quite a splash in a recent Iowa political event for social conservatives hosted by Congressman Steve King. Some polling there places him right at the top of the heap. His remarks were viewed favorably by GOP voters. It looks like he's walking and talking like a candidate. Let's talk about Governor Walker's strategy so far.
Well, I mean, I think the governor's running for president. He hasn't announced it formally, but he has organized a fundraising sort of arm that's not a PAC. That's a 527. But he was down at Steve King's event in Iowa. He was very well received with regard to his speech there. He's been down to Iowa a number of times over the last 4 years. He's also been to New Hampshire. I believe he's also going to New Hampshire in the near future. He's been to some of the fundraising events in other places that aren't New Hampshire or Iowa. I think he's developing his presidential campaign. He's looking at people who are going to staff it. He's looking at how it's going to look as compared to some of the other people who are in the field. And I think that's where we are at this point. We'll have the first, the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary about a little bit less than a year from now.
Well, yesterday the governor was on ABC's This Week, and this probably wasn't the very first time he was on national media, but it certainly has been was the first time I think he was on a national news show like this as a potential candidate in 2016. And he was asked about his candidacy. He said, "Don't count me out." And there are probably some people who handicap these things. Who may be low rating him or not taking him seriously enough, but he's been a pretty shrewd campaigner, and it's the evidence here in Wisconsin is that he knows how to win elections.
Yeah, and I actually don't know that many sort of folks who are pretty on the ball who have been counting him out, and I think that may be a suggestion to possibly some of the other candidates in the field. And possibly also Democratic opponents, not to count him out. But certainly, I mean, you're right. He was on This Week yesterday as a potential presidential candidate, but he's done quite a few Sunday morning shows during his time as governor. And I think it was in a capacity to, sort of get his name out and his comments out on a more national venue in anticipation of running for president. And I had said, if he wins his second term as governor, he's running for president.
Well, the nobody would have taken that bet. This was the first time, though. I mean, the times that he's been on the Sunday talk shows, he's been talking about what he's done in Wisconsin.
Right.
His message is anti-Washington, and that's going to play really well out in the hustings, as they say. But this was the first time that I know of that he was really asked a number of questions about foreign policy, which obviously, if you're the president, you don't just deal with domestic issues. We have a cut here from yesterday's This Week on ABC television, and Governor Walker's, this was particularly a question about ISIS and the situation in Syria. Let's play that now.
And you talk about big, bold, fresh ideas. What's your big, bold, fresh idea in Syria?
Well, I think I go back to the red line. I think
let's not go back. Let's go forward. What's your big, bold idea?
I think aggressively we need to take the fight to ISIS and any other radical Islamic terrorist in and around the world, because it's not a matter of when they attempt an attack on American soil, or not if, I should say, it's when. And we need leadership that says clearly, not only amongst the United States, but amongst our allies, that we're willing to take appropriate action. I think it should be surgical.
You don't think 2,000 airstrikes is taking it to ISIS in Syria, in Iraq?
I think we need to have an aggressive strategy anywhere around the world. I think it's a mistake.
So what does that mean? I don't know what aggressive strategy means. If we're bombing and we've done 2,000 airstrikes, what does an aggressive strategy mean in foreign policy?
I think anywhere and everywhere we have to go beyond just aggressive airstrikes. We have to look at other surgical methods. And ultimately, we have to be prepared to put boots on the ground if that's what it takes. Because I think,
boots on the ground in Syria? U.S. Boots on the ground in Syria?
I don't think that's an immediate plan, but I think anywhere in the world...
You wouldn't rule that out?
I wouldn't rule anything out. I think when you have the lives of Americans at stake and our freedom-loving allies anywhere in the world, we have to be prepared to do things that don't allow those measures, those attacks, those abuses to come to our shores.
Okay, Governor Walker with ABC reporter Martha Raddatz, who pressed him pretty hard on the question of Syria. Talk a little bit about that. In terms of a presidential candidate, how would you rate that response?
Well, I think it was, as a presidential candidate, at this point, it was aggressive, but perhaps didn't have a lot of details. And I think, when you say anywhere and everywhere and boots on the ground, you start to position yourself as we're going to go in with the United States military to a lot of places. And the American populace is not all that excited, for the most part, about going in everywhere with, our soldiers. To fight everything. I mean, again, it's difficult because you've got different forms of threats in lots of different places. But it sounded pretty big in terms of U.S. commitments.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to put on your presidential expert hat for just a moment. Is it fair at this point in the campaign to expect anybody who's running for president to have a fully fleshed out and well-developed foreign policy?
No, but something like Syria, which has been a point of controversy and in the media and has a lot of moving pieces, it's probably expected that you might have a more clearly defined, this is where we should be moving in that realm if I were president.
Okay. 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson. Lily Gorin is with me, professor of political science at Carroll University. We were talking of budgets earlier. Of course, the governor has his budget message to the state legislature tomorrow night. We'll get to hear more about his plans. Obviously, then once he announces his budget and sends it to the legislature, the Committee on Joint Finance takes it up. And a lot of things will happen to it between now and July 1st. The governor wants to get the budget wrapped up quickly, probably so that he can get out on the campaign trail. But that would just be speculation on my part, and that's how talk show hosts get into trouble. But the president of the United States, President Obama, he announced his budget plans in the State of the Union message. His budget is being transmitted to Congress this week. What do you think the chances are that any of the ideas that he talked about in the State of the Union speech will eventually become the law of the land?
Very little. There may be, I mean, you heard the immediate discussion in the aftermath of the State of the Union address was that there may be one or two places where the president and his supporters in Congress and the Republicans in the House and the Senate, who now have majorities in both houses, might have some areas of collaboration, but not a lot. Not a lot.
Yeah, well, interesting. I mean, and I think we can expect the president's veto pen to be quite active over the next couple of years. We'll just have to see how things play out. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have some callers who want to talk about things like right to work and audits of organizations. We are going to talk about vaccines and the anti-vaccine vote. I didn't even know there was such a thing, but according to The Atlantic, there is. And I know, Lily, you pointed that story out to me. So we'll be sure to talk about that and whatever else is on people's minds for the rest of this hour at 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org works just as well. You can also find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. So get in touch one way or the other. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's All Things Political on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, is my guest. Let's go back to the phones, and Ray is with us from Milwaukee. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John, and hi to your guests. John, you know, you really should have your own show. You do a great job. But other than that, right to work, I'm a union worker here in Milwaukee. I work for a union that's been around for more than 100 years here. And I just wonder, across the state, there are other union workers listening right now. I know there are. And some of these workers actually may be 30 to 40% of union workers in the rural areas voted for Scott Walker. And I wonder what they think about this right to work for less, and also why the road builders were exempt from this legislation. I'd really wish one of them would call in and give us a reflection on how they feel things are going, since it's going to affect all of us.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Lily Gorin, the governor has kind of signaled he really hopes that the legislature doesn't take up right to work. The legislature has said they're going to fast-track it.
Yeah, this is one of the difficulties of running for president. As you also noted earlier, that he would like the budget to be wrapped up earlier rather than later. And I don't think he wants to have another really high visibility fight with unions, which I think the right to work bill would in fact engender in this state. And I think that, you know, it certainly promoted him with regard to a national visibility with regard to the, you know, the changing of the law in terms of collective bargaining with the teachers unions. But if he were to be facing again, you know, sort of the situation that we saw in the immediate response to those proposals, it would not necessarily promote Scott Walker as, like, let's get things done, roll up our shirt sleeves, let's just do the work. It would be another picture of a pretty divisive situation, which, of course, is what we've been seeing through pretty much the entire Obama administration. And so it might not be the sort of frame or positioning that Scott Walker would like to have as a potential presidential candidate. I think that's part of what's going on in terms of his position on it, at least, you know, sort of publicly, and where the legislature is with it.
Ray, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Rocky in Berlin next. Rocky, thanks for joining us today. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just trying to state that I agree with Walker's concept of going to Syria and fighting, but only if they go to fight a war and not to go to play pussy with the people. I served as a Vietnam veteran. In the last 6 months I was there, I was told I couldn't, if I was fired on by the enemy, I couldn't return fire unless I called in for permission. And that's not a way to fight a war. You don't win that. So he's got to go to fight it, and I stand behind him.
All right, Rocky, thanks for the call. Lily Gorn, some support for the idea of boots on the ground in Syria.
I think, you know, again, it should be a national conversation among the American people if we're going to be sending a lot of soldiers in on the ground in Syria, because it's going to be a very messy undertaking.
I have I had an email from somebody who knew that what the show was today, but wasn't going to be able to comment during the program, who said, well, we like to talk a lot about fighting for freedom, but generally when we say that, we're talking about paying someone else to do it. And I'm not going to comment on the rightness or wrongness of that statement, but it is certainly a way to look at it. Let's take a call next from Frank in Onalaska, who has a different political story to talk about today. Frank, go ahead.
Thanks for taking the call. I think we need to address the continuing use of audits to move forward conservative agendas. The recent request for a full audit of the Planned Parenthood organizations in the state underlies the intentions of the conservatives to undercut, you know, Planned Parenthood and what they perceive as abortion-related legislation. And I'd like to contrast the lack of need for an audit of something like that with what I think is then the lack of a true audit of the Wisconsin Economic Development Organization, where they've lost millions of dollars unaccounted for in terms of loans. They don't know where the money went, and that speaks of theft, not just poor accounting.
Mm-hmm. Frank, thanks so much for the call. The state using audits against Planned Parenthood, Lily Gorn, a political tactic?
Well, I mean, I think certainly you have seen this in lots of cases in terms of states or the national government looking into organizations they may not be supportive of through things like audits or investigations to try to find wrongdoing. This is not something that's necessarily new. But it's also not something that's in the headline, because you have to explain what it means, why, you know, this might be not quite harassment but like it. For any organization. I mean, this was part of the critique with regard to the IRS and some of the Tea Party organizations, except that it turned out the IRS was doing that to everybody. And so, you know, you sort of do see this because nobody likes to get audited. You know, individuals don't like it, organizations don't like it.
Well, it's an expense, for
it
one
is.
Thing.
It is.
It costs money to have someone come in and do that kind of work. Okay, one of the other national stories that we're watching, which I didn't really think was political until this weekend, is the whole issue of whether to vaccinate or not to vaccinate. We had the president in a pre-Super Bowl interview. He was asked about the measles outbreak, which apparently began at Disneyland.
Yeah.
Of all places.
Yeah.
And the CDC reported more than 100 cases of measles in 14 states. And that was, measles was a disease we pretty much had wiped out. The president said this: the science is, you know, pretty indisputable. We've looked at this again and again. There is every reason to get vaccinated, but there aren't reasons to not. You should get your kids vaccinated. So the president said that. Okay, well, pretty straight up. Now here's New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was asked about vaccines during a trip to England. And here's what Chris Christie had to say. We vaccinate ours, and so, you know, that's the best expression I can give you of my opinion. He meant our kids. You know, it's much more important what you think as a parent than what you think as a public official, and that's what we do. But I also understand that parents need to have some measure of choice in things as well. So that's the balance that government has to decide. Now, Twitter exploded after the governor said that. Let's talk about his response compared to President Obama's and the political ramifications of that.
Well, I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a physician. I actually have a cousin who studies this, and And, you know, she has said again and again, and she's been on PBS programs, and she's been interviewed extensively with regard to this, that you know, some of the difficulties that we're seeing with regard to these outbreaks of things like measles is that the vaccine is based in part on the herd, on everybody doing it, so that you're all protected. And you're seeing these sort of pockets where there are these breakouts, and it's you know, in very well-to-do communities in large measure, where people are sort of putting in the opting out option. And that's where you're seeing also where Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, has, you know, sort of suggested that, well, let other people's voices be heard. But this is becoming very controversial now.
But they, as President Obama pointed out, the science here is settled. It's not like there's any kind of a debate. The one study that purported to show a link between vaccines and autism was proven to be false.
Yes.
It was totally debunked, and
yes.
And so there isn't any scientific controversy over whether or not being vaccinated is an advantage.
Yes, that's
and
true.
And so, you know, given that, it's you know, well, I don't know. We're not doing a show on vaccinations, but it certainly is probably going to become an issue. And as you pointed out, it kind of blew up on Governor Christie. I'm not sure that people necessarily understood the nuance of what he was talking about. He certainly wasn't in favor of. He was certainly was not opposed to people getting vaccinated, if that's what people thought. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, I just realized I forgot to do something that, and I hope we're still friends. I didn't mention that you have a new book that's coming out in March that you co-edited called Mad Men in Politics. And I'd wanted to mention that earlier in the program. I apologize for not doing so.
That's fine.
In my defense, I'll plead too many pieces of paper in front of me at one time.
Well, I appreciate you plugging it now, John, so we're still friends.
Okay, good. So what's this book about?
The book is from a bunch of different perspectives, and it's looking at the television show, Matt Weiner's television show, Mad Men. And it's sort of wondering and asking the question, this is the research that professors do sometimes, you know, why was a television show about the 1960s become such a part of our cultural sort of atmosphere? And how is it talking to us now in 2015? When we look back and all the people who were in the show are drinking and smoking all the time, which, you know, none of us ever do anymore, particularly not at lunchtime, at least.
Well, not all the time.
Or not all the time. But there's a lot within the show about nationalism and patriotism, about feminism and race, and about sort of understanding America that, you know, that sort of, you watch a show, you enjoy a television show, just like you read a novel, you enjoy a novel. But my co-authors and I were sort of wondering, you know, there's a little bit more there to it. And while it has a small audience, it has won a lot of awards, and it has, you know, it has sort of made its way into our cultural conversations. Banana Republic has done full clothing lines about it. President Obama mentioned it in the State of the Union address with regard to equal pay. You know, it's sort of the ideas that are in Mad Men have sort of come through in lots of different and interesting ways, because my co-authors and I think there's something there.
And I see it comes out in paperback March 12th.
Yes. I think March 26th, I think.
Oh, 26th? Okay, well, somebody needs to tell Amazon that.
Okay, well, maybe March 12th. But I'm doing a reading at Boswell in Milwaukee on the 9th of April, and I think it's a good book. I like
it. Okay. All right. Well, I'll look for it.
All right.
Going back to the vaccination question for just a moment, this is an issue of trust on the part of some parents. They don't trust the government. They don't trust even scientists when it comes to vaccines. And this brings up something that last week we were talking about. The period of time when President Johnson was president, and surveys at that time had three quarters of the population trusted the government to do the right thing most of the time, And today, that's probably closer to 10 or 20%.
Yeah.
The whole vaccine question, the controversy isn't about the science or the medicine involved. It's about trust and about the trust that people have or don't have in the government or in science itself or in the medical profession. Wouldn't you say that's probably a fair characterization?
Yeah, I'm not even sure it's the medical profession. I think it becomes more about the science itself. And you know, you see some of the same controversy with regard to questions about climate change and global warming, with regard to the science itself. You know, a lot of times individual, you know, patients trust their doctors, or most of their doctors. And so, you know, as sort of as a group, we sort of say, yeah, we pretty much think that they're telling us the truth most of the time. But you periodically hear these stories about pharmaceutical companies who've got all these physicians who are pushing their drugs. And that's where some of this trust breaks down. But the question of, as you noted with regard to the vaccines, this debunked study with regard to autism's connection to vaccines, that it's been debunked, it's been studied repeatedly, and re-debunked.
Yeah. Millions of dollars have been spent debunking a study that was later revealed to pretty much have been fake to begin with. So, you know, yeah, there's that. But because of the internet and other things, it's sort of this zombie study. It's you can't kill it. It keeps coming back to life. But it, just to go back to the trust issue a little bit, there seems to be a great deal of resistance to science on a number of fronts. We could talk about the science of climate change, for example, and you know, things like that. So we're less inclined to accept what scientists tell us. That's probably fodder for an entire 54 minutes of talk radio another day. But it manifests itself in the political arena when candidates seize on that mistrust then and use it as part of their campaign.
Exactly. And I mean, I think you note the Johnson statistic from the time of Lyndon Johnson's administration, which was subsequently followed by Richard Nixon and Watergate. And the mistrust numbers start to go down following, some of the stuff that was revealed about the Johnson administration with regard to Pentagon Papers and what was going on in Vietnam, but certainly snowballed after Watergate. And you've just seen sort of more and more and more of that.
Well, then you had Ronald Reagan campaigning on government is not the solution, it's the problem.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, if you keep blaming the government for everything that's wrong, people will blame the government for everything that's wrong. And then you don't trust that the government can do anything right.
Well, it certainly makes life a lot simpler. And then you have a whole generation of people who grew up, never trust the man.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's kind of a perfect storm. Unfortunately, there's a public health consequence in this case. The lack of vaccinations is compromising people with weak immune systems. You talked about herd immunity. That's the key to vaccination. And if people aren't going to get vaccinated, we're already seeing some very bad side effects. You had the political aspect to this. I was just reminded by my producers, the political aspect of this whole vaccination thing may be a little bit similar to the way we jumped all over the Ebola crisis.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the potential for death from measles is much higher than the potential that anybody in the domestic United States is going to get Ebola and die from it.
There you go.
And we have a way of preventing the measles. We're working on the Ebola vaccine. I mean, that's the interesting part. Everybody was running around during the Ebola crisis saying, where's the vaccine? Where's the vaccine?
Well, and we've already got one for measles. I got the measles before the vaccine. That's how old I am. Lily Gorin, thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on, John.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University and co-editor of the book Mad Men and Politics, coming out in paperback sometime in March, depending on who you believe. This hour of programming was produced by K.P. Whaley, who also handled on-air production. And, of course, it takes a village to make a talk show, so there are always dozens of people involved. Kathleen Dunn's on vacation. She'll be back next week. In the meantime, I'm John Munson. I'll be here through Thursday. Enjoy the shows. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.